You are on.
Thank you. I think you'd be right to say that the problem of suffering has become particularly 20th, 21st century subject, which in a magnitude which it wasn't in earlier generations. It could be because of warfare and so on, but there's been plenty enough war and plenty enough aggression and pain that people have inflicted on each other before. But I think largely in Europe it's so because people began to break away from a traditional, although incorrect, view in Christianity that God was ordaining everything that was happening. If that's so, then you've got a solution to the problem of suffering straight away. It says that if it's happening, it must be right because God's ordaining it. So God chooses what is right. If he does something which we think might be wrong, it can't be wrong because God's chosen it, so it must be right. So everything's all right, really. And that's why that is one escape route that people enter into, far more perhaps than you're aware, because even where free will is regularly and properly understood, you still find people talking about, I wonder what God's doing to me, and why am I going through this, and that kind of statement is an evidence they've never really got to grasp or got to grips with the sort of philosophy of the Bible concerning the world and the universe. Since really the 17th century and the Enlightenment, we've seen a lot of thinkers who've tackled that problem and have dismissed what they have regarded as a Christian view, because it isn't a Christian view. It's one which has been imposed upon the scriptures, taking one or two suitable verses. Because everybody really, deep down, has got a problem about suffering. I've already explained the first view, which some sort of Christians, Calvinist Christians, have resolved the problem by saying if it's happening, God's ordaining it, then it's all right. Somehow or other, everything will be all right, really. The second view that people have taken is what might be called the animistic view. That isn't so much that there's no truth in it. There is some truth in the fact that a lot of suffering does come along the demonic lines. In fact, that is far more healthy than blaming God for it. But the animists see everything of suffering as coming from Satan, and therefore you have in some way or other offended the powers that be. And so you have to appease the spirits, and you do it in various rituals and in various ways that they invent to try and lift the threat of suffering off people's backs. Deists say, well, it is God's fault in a way, but he's not really involved in it, so there's no problem about that. You just got to get on with life anyway. That is, those who think God made the world, wound it off, threw it off into space, and has moved off for a holiday, and therefore has really no interest, no involvement. He's not maintaining, as the Bible says, all things by the word of his power and causing them to cohere by his truth and his goodness. It's not that. They say there's this mechanical world that was particularly prominent in the 17th, 18th centuries, where a mechanical universe was being recognized. Everything going by mathematics, planets never moving out of order, and so on and so forth. But of course that kind of universe is one in which there's no place really for the interaction of persons. People don't interact because it's just the automatic working out of what has already been ordained and written in from the beginning of the universe. So it's a similar kind of Calvinistic escape into a kind of a refuge away from suffering, but it's just not quite blaming God quite so much, because he just has made it all up and left it, because he's too big to bother about little squirts like we are running around a huge great universe which is far too big for us, because we can't even imagine it, let alone anything else. And even 7 billion and 7.5 billion of us aren't going to make much sense of it all, so we just put up with that. Another way in which people have tried to deal with it are amongst the Hindus. Strictly speaking, suffering for a Hindu is the outworking of karma. It's the outworking of things you've done that were bad in the past life. Now they're coming back on you. That's one way. But also, suffering itself is an illusion. It's not real. It's something that we have created in our own minds as we look at things. And so suffering is an illusion, because everything in the end really is an illusion, including yourself. So that doesn't get us very far in trying to deal with the problem, but it is a way that people have tried to deal with it. I've just got some others written. Yeah, the Buddhists, they say that suffering, they don't like suffering, but you remember the story of Buddha when he was kept from every problem in the world by a very rich father, and one day he found a dead gardener, and he was confronted with something he couldn't cope with, and so he began his search of enlightenment, trying to find enlightenment. And in the end, it's a very similar sort of situation with Buddhism, that you've got to live above it, because it isn't the reality. The reality is not the suffering that's going on. You just, in a sense, run away from it. It's the reason why in Buddhist countries there has until recently not been very much done for particularly children who are born with deficiencies, educational problems, and the sort of suffering that goes into families through those sorts of things. You just have to pretend it isn't there. And therefore you leave your children who are deficient or causing pain and so on and so forth. You just leave them out of your picture. And that was what they did to children. They just left them. And they left them to suffer and to die. So it's a new thing in places like Thailand, where we're working, where they have begun to collect up damaged children and try to care for them. Of course, the more you do that, and you get government permission to do it, the more people begin to take notice, oh, we've got a problem here. Well, there's a problem that doesn't fit their philosophy at all, because they try to live above the fact that suffering is there and that you might be suffering. So these are just different ways. Muslims, gone around the complete circle, and we've landed up with Augustine again, because he probably taught them. And Muslims take exactly the same view. If everything that is happening is ordained of God, which they say it is, then of course there is no way of charging God with the problem that many want to charge him with, that there is so much suffering. Evolution came along and gave another sort of a answer to the issue. Evolution says that it's really just the way that whoever it was, if there was a God, created life, that the might is right and the strong will come out on top, and the weak go to the wall. Might is right in a sense in their whole viewpoint, because the strength of a species will always overtake the weak species and eliminate them. The survival of the fittest was the key buzzword that was set up in the 19th century to explain what evolution was doing. The survival of the fittest, and it's only the strongest that come out on top. And that is just how it is. That's very similar to humanists too. It's just how it is, so you have to put up with it. There's nothing you can, nobody you can blame. You don't blame God, you don't blame anybody. You might get rid of God by, in a sense, trying to blame him, like what's that chap on the television, Fry? Yes, he just dismisses it all in that sense, that God looks so wicked that he made cancers and causes these things to happen, and therefore we don't want anything to do with them. And that's another way in which people have tried to cope with it. Now, we are the people, we Christians, who've got the problem. we got the problem because we say God is good. But of course, because he's God, then he's almighty. That's not necessarily a Christian statement, but it's nearly. It's rather Greek philosophy that define God's in omniscience, all knowledge, omnipotence, all power, with the concept of immutability, that he's always the same, and therefore you can judge him 100 years ago, you can judge him today, and you can make your statements about him because he's immutable, he never changes. Makes it impossible to have a personal relationship with him, if that is the case. If God knows everything, it's no good saying, "Nice day, God, thanks for the sun shining." He said, "Well, I knew it would, I did it." So there's no real relationship, is there? So we've got a problem, if that's the viewpoint that some people try to take on, but it has been foisted upon Christianity, lifted lock, stock and barrel, an impassibility. That is, there's no... How can you have a relationship if you can't empathically identify with other people? Feel with them, sorry. And you can't feel with them, you can't sympathize, you can't empathize. And therefore the impassibility of God is that you're just dealing with, well, as some people have described it, like a great marble pillar, tall, beyond our reach, doesn't move, put your arms around it, doesn't respond, it's impassible. God is not moved at all, emotionally. But we Christians have got the problem. If God is love and God is all-powerful, if he is, and there is a word, pantocrator, you get it once in the book of Revelation, in the whole of the Bible, in the book of Revelation. Pan, all, tokrata, panta rather, and kratos. Kratos is power, all power. Now, in a sense, in the end, a creator has got to be the one with all power. But there is also a qualification that although God is all power, he gives some of it away. And that is being a creature. As soon as a creature is made, some level of power is given to it. It doesn't mean to say then if he doesn't do too well, you take it away again, because then you haven't given it to him. So it never really is there. Because here's God waiting for you to misuse your power, takes it away from you, as some people want him to. And in actual fact, that creature has never... It doesn't really exist, a creature with a will to choose and to make its own expressions and exertions of power. Of course, there are some powers that might have to be working all the time for that power to keep the universe going. And possibly there are. You know, obviously, we see angelic creatures in some way or other who are tied up in the universe of God, and that they are called Elohim, they're called powers. So the powers are the energies that are put into a lot of the things which perhaps haven't got other personality than the thing that's behind it. And God has made it that way. He gives away his power. So in some senses we've already got a qualification on what is popularly and rightly understood. All power comes from him. If God chooses, shall we say, to immediately today judge all evil, and he can because he's all powerful, then he stops all sin. That means you and me as well. And so the whole thing comes to a halt as we're brought to account. And then that bringing us to account means that everything is finished. So if God exerts his ability of all power and withdrawing it where he's given it and brought it back to the final judgment, then we've come to an end and the judgment day has arrived. So when we say God is all powerful, it doesn't mean to say he couldn't do something about it, but we're just saying he wouldn't do something about it because he's very fair and he's very just. And if he judges me because of my sin, and you got the same sin in your heart, they have to judge you too. That's so he calls in the day of judgment straight away. So there is a limit then when we think about the all-powering God, but not a limit that all power doesn't come from him. It does. But a limit on how that power, when it's handed out to various parts of his creation, how much he would take back again before the final day of judgment. Big question mark. It's a little bit like God's playing chess. Let's pretend he's playing chess with the devil, and the devil is trying to get a lot of evil things done, and God's trying to keep a lot of good things going and win the business. And then he decides, well, the devil's doing so well, the only way I can deal with this, and he puts his arm through the ball and sweeps it off and says, well, I'm all power, I've taken it back. Yes, and the devil sneers at him, saying, yes, we'll see more of this when we look at the book of Job. Because what God has done is broken all the rules in order to win the game. And that's why some people complain that God isn't doing miracles every day, thousands of them for everybody, everywhere. He possibly is, but not in the way that we expect it. We want him to do miracles here, there, and everywhere, which are breaking the rules of the game. And if you break the rules of the game, there's no game at all. So the whole thing is nonsense. It's meaningless. So God does stick to the rules. That's why there are vast numbers of most magnificent miracles that you can think of, apart from the fact that the universe itself is a miracle. He used a lot of power on that one to bring it into being. So he's not going to undo it all overnight just because we happen to not know the answer in this philosophical question. And it's that he is a God who has got all power but doesn't want to use it all the time, because if he does so, then he can't have creatures that he has deputed. He has he's made deputies carrying his authority and his ability of power, even if they're using it badly and wrongly. You begin to get a picture? So that's the kind of universe that we assert that we're in. And so we don't fall into the trap when people throw it at you. If God is all love and God is all power, then how is it that, and they use an illustration, come on guys, as consistent as ever, and people say, therefore, if you were a loving father and your child is dying with something or is in pain, and you've got the ability because you've got the power to do something about it, wouldn't you do something about it? If you don't, then you're not all loving. If you do and you stop it, then you're in the place where you've used your almightiness, and almightiness has taken over at that point. And as I've explained, that's very unfair for everybody else. That's the thing to bear in mind, isn't it? When we're trying to get to the solution of this problem. So God is either all-powerful, and he can do anything he likes, and nobody gets any suffering, or he's all-loving, and he's given us the ability of free will, not predetermined, not ruled over, and we have to choose where we're in this framework, why it is working out the way that it is. So, there are two questions that I've over the years thrown out, not questions, assertions, which are very useful to begin to clear the ground so we can start to try our way through what is one of the most difficult. It's called theodicy, that is the justice of God. Can God be just, and at the same time can he be all-loving? Is it a contradiction in terms, or is it possible? Odyssey. The dick part, the dissy or dicky, is the word for justice. God's justice. Theodicy. Well, these two assertions. First, God did not create evil. Now, that's a popular one. Why did God create evil? He did not create evil, neither did he create anything or anyone evil. If God is light, and he creates us and sets us in the light so we can know him, and we build a box and jump inside and pull the lid down, then that absence of light, of course, is a problem inside the box. And if we treat God in that way and keep him out, or if God makes a tree, similar thing, God makes a tree and you cut a branch down and it's an apple tree, it's supposed to be giving you apples to eat or bits of wood to build nice houses, but you cut down a nice plank and wallop your neighbor over the head with it and beat his skull in, you could say, well, why did God make the tree? It's his fault we got trees. But the fault is the way that you've taken up what he has made and misused it. And it's the misuse of truth that begins to reveal that there is such a thing as evil. If God makes a supernatural being, if he makes some being called the archangel, Satan, and he decides to rebel, then he can be an evil being, but not because he was created evil. The very fact he knows how to make himself out as an angel of light shows he knows a little bit about the light. But you can only be evil insofar as you exclude the light. You can only be evil insofar as you misuse something God has made. You only become evil when you make a choice to act or to act into somebody else or something else in an evil manner. So God created nothing that is evil. He did not create Satan. This is a common way that some people have tried to combat the Christian revelation. He did not create evil or anything or anyone evil. He made the universe in which you could create it. And when it comes to sin, you are not made to sin. You've got the strange doctrine, again, it's born out of European Calvinism, Augustinian Calvinism, the strange sort of idea amongst many Christians that you're born a sinner. Anybody believe that? They think they got one or two verses for it. Won't bother about them. We are not born sinners, and therefore we're all going to be judged and condemned because we're born sinners. That would be most unjust, wouldn't it? And if you blame it all onto Adam, as some people do, misreading Romans chapter 5, if you blame it all onto Adam and say, well, he made me a sinner, I've been conceived and brought forth as a sinner, misusing the psalm, which one there are only about two verses they ever use for this nonsense. If you, we'll come to those in a minute, if we were born sinners, of course then we will sin. But if we choose to be sinners, then of course God can judge us justly. But God will not be judged. If you put an axe into a baby's hand and he brings it down on his mother's head or something, you don't blame the baby. You blame whoever let the baby have the axe to play with. And that's the sort of nonsense that some people come out with. We choose to sin. Sin is born inside us, not outside, out there somewhere. Okay? When we are not made to sin, we choose to sin. We might give in to the temptations of sin and Satan and say, I want to go his way because it's got some fruits that will suit me. But it's still, that choice starts in here. It's created within us. God did not create sin. He did not create evil. It begins inside me, or in some creature, even if it's a supernatural creature. And therefore, that's all those sorts of ideas we have to contend with if we're going to try and think our way and pray our way through this problem. Evil is not a self-existing entity found in man's actions to another, it's found rather in actions to another man or another creature by going beyond our prescription. Obvious kind of cases, if you walk over precipices, you break your neck, that is because you were never made to walk over precipices. If you try to live underwater and you drown, you don't blame God. You were never made to live underwater. If we seek to do things outside the prescription of what it means to be made in God's image and to do God things, we will destroy ourselves and other people and cause pain in other people. There is a corollary to this, which is that God might use evil in the end to serve his purposes. That's not surprising, because he is God. He made everything, it all belongs to him. But if you sin, you remember the story, which often you'll get Christians quoting on this matter, about Joseph, and when the brothers came, and obviously they were very, either repented or certainly very fearful of what Joseph might do to them in retribution. The answer of Joseph was, God, you used this, you made it, did this for evil. God used this for bringing about the salvation of the whole of the Egyptian empire and a lot more besides. So God did it, used it for good. And of course the outstanding event is the cross itself. He was put to death by the hands of wicked men, it says very clearly. So evil put him on the cross, but God has turned that round and used that evil to bring about the salvation of the world. That is the most outstanding, if you like, example. So because God can use evil and get good out of it, doesn't mean that God ordains it. It's very different altogether. If you've learned something because you did something wrong and it hurt you, for instance, walking over the cliff and breaking your neck or whatever it is you want to use as an illustration, if you do something that's wrong and you were never meant to do and you weren't made for that and it's brought pain to you, of course you can say, thank you, Lord, you've taught me something. But God didn't ordain that that's the way you should learn it. There are one or two prescriptive things that God has given. Don't eat of the tree of good and evil. And there's a complete and obvious disobedience, whether they understood it or not. But if Adam and Eve, before they fell, were walking along and therefore didn't have any shoes or any clothes for that matter on, and Adam puts his foot on a stone, he learns pain. And therefore he learns not to put his foot on a stone. So he can turn around to Eve and say, excuse me, my dear, or however they got on together, if you put your foot there, it's going to hurt you, so please put it over there. And you learn to bless other people through what you've experienced. Now, in that kind of way, you can learn some of God's principles, some of God's laws, that putting your feet on craggy stones is going to be painful and hurt, and you can do good out of that by saving somebody else for doing it. But that doesn't mean to say God ordained that these craggy stones are there for you to put your foot on, and that therefore now you can teach your wife not to do it. That is not the way. It's that it's out of the circumstances. You may have learned something which is good, even though God didn't ordain that it should be there to give you pain or anybody else that you're trying to save them from. So there is that corollary to the fact that you do something which God can now use to bring about his purpose. That's the first assertion that I wanted to get written. Well, there's one other aspect to that. Could somebody look up 2 Samuel chapter 24 verse 1 and somebody look up 1 Chronicles 21 verse 1. 2 Samuel 24 verse 1, 1 Chronicles 21 verse 1.
Now when again the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them to say, go, number Israel and Judah.
Thank you. Chronicles.
Then Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Verse 2. So David said to Joab and to the princes of the people, go number Israel from Beersheba even to Dan, and bring me word that I may know their number.
Same story, same verb. In one case it says God moved David, in the other case it says Satan moved David. Now, is that a contradiction? So we throw the Bible away? It's got a contradiction in it? Or is something being said from two points of view? What do you think? Same verb. They both moved him. I mean, you might say David hasn't got a chance, has he? Satan's pushing him, God's pushing him. It's no wonder he did it. Yeah. Yeah. But can we get any further? When God says, I will bring down the Assyrians because of the sin of Israel, and they will be taken away into exile, and then another time he says, and Nebuchadnezzar rose up with great fury and surrounded Jerusalem and took away the... Which one is it? Is it Nebuchadnezzar? Or is it God that's doing it? Well, the Old Testament in particular, not so much the New. The New is very clear. God is light, and in him there's no darkness at all. There's no evil, there's no darkness, there's nothing that you might say is deceitful or equivocal or in some way or other pretending he's one thing and doing another. I'm trying to think of the right word. But I'm trying to get to the philosophy that must lie behind being able to say both of these statements. Have you not thought of it before? Thank you. There's one person listening. No, most people haven't. They either just dismiss it and say, well, it's just a contradiction, that's all, yeah, scribal error or something. But with Nebuchadnezzar, it's a bit hard, much more difficult there. The Calvinist says, well, of course, it's all the same thing. Because God does it and Satan does it, that's all the same. Well, my answer is, I think that the nearest I can get to it is to say that the Bible does talk in different, if you like, sets of views and terminologies and windows to look through. And in the final analysis, God, of course, is the ultimate cause of all effects. The ultimate cause. The ultimate cause in snooker, when you play a ball, is the rod or the man who's using the billiard cue, snooker cue, but the effects are that the balls bang onto each other with the hope that one of them goes into a pocket. And so there are lots of effects that come from an action, and God ultimately takes responsibility because he is God and he is the creator, and he did make it the way that it is, in brackets. Probably there is no other way of making a free will universe than to do it with these dangers in it, these risks and these problems. But he, in the end, is taking the responsibility for all that is taking place. He's not ordaining it, he is not wishing it, but he is taking responsibility for it. Very simply, if he sees that Satan is going to tempt you and lead you astray and do some pretty evil stuff, of course, because he's all power, he could just smite the devil like that and knock him out. Could do. But he doesn't, because that would be denying what he's given you, which is the ability to accept or not accept. Some people want God to do that all the time, keep knocking things off in order to stop us doing bad things. But in fact, that will not be a universe in which he will have creatures like ourselves who are looking like him. And nobody questions that God hasn't got a free will, because he has. And we've got that free will. So we either choose to go in Satan's way, or we choose to acknowledge that God is behind it all, and what I choose is in line with his ultimate wishes, not of the things that some of his creatures are pressing me to do. Alright? So the fact that God can put it over in the scripture, especially in the Old Testament, much clearer in the New. In the Old Testament terminology, that either God does it or Satan does it, it just simply means that God is saying, in the final analysis, if it's, you think it's unjust, you will be recompensed. You will ultimately be blessed. You will find in the new heaven and the new earth that it was worth it all in the end. Now you can't say that unless you're a believer. Unless you're trusting the God who is revealed in the scripture as a God of love and who looks like Jesus. If you've seen that, you can say, yes, I can trust that God in the end will make recompense for all that I think that I seem to have lost by being in the universe like it is. The Lord promises in, that with this present suffering is not to be compared with the glory that should be revealed to us. And that is the hope of the gospel. We talk a lot about faith and we talk a lot about love, but if you've got faith and love, ultimately you need hope. And that hope is that God will take the final judgment and we will be recompensed, and ultimately evil will be judged. So in that sense, God takes the responsibility for it, that he keeps the universe going, and therefore he keeps sinners going, and sinners keep on sinning. So you can say in one sense that God does it. You say in the second sense, looking through another window, oh no, but really man did it. He had the ability to do it, or Satan did it, or whatever. That's the only way I can see that these contradictory statements can be understood. But it makes an awful lot of sense of getting us deeper into the events of this universe and to see the philosophy that lies behind it, as to why saying that God did it and Satan did it at the same time is because God is taking responsibility. If I keep a universe going where you can suffer loss, then my promise is in the end you will get more than that. Sufferings are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed. And on the basis of that, we can trust that he's bringing something out of it, even though he allows the universe to carry on with all its problems, sin and suffering in it anyway. Alright, any questions?
In terms of the Old Testament as well, would you look at it as partial revelation as well? But
well, I was trying to get beyond that. You couldn't, some people do, have argued in that kind of way. It's only half the story. But the trouble with half-truths is that they can often be very misleading. It's true that truth has developed as you go through, but it is not any different. It's developed in our understanding of different facets of what belong to it, but it's still the same truth. It's not as though it's something completely different, that you could say something in the Old Testament. It's all to do, of course, with the vision of God that we have too. You could say it's partial if at the same time you acknowledge that it's not, that it's contradictory to what is further revealed in the new. It says, for instance, Jesus brought to light life and immortality, and life and immortality are only hinted at in the Old Testament. Jesus brings it to light through his own death and resurrection. So he brings it to light so we can see it more clearly. So yes, that's, if you like, an advance in Revelation when we come into the New Testament. Particularly, of course, Jesus brings new revelation, but it's all based on the old. It doesn't contradict what we've got in the Old Testament. That's why we do have to read the Old Testament through the eyes of the new. So in that sense, what you're saying would be just about acceptable, that it's further revelation, and it's only partial revelation in the Old Testament. But partial revelation, partial truth, can be a lie. If you only give half the truth, it's a lie. That's why we need the New Testament to read the old.
So, like, from that, in the areas where you have contradiction, God is described as the agent of suffering, like in the Exodus or slaughter when people go to battle. How do we view that then?
You're bringing up other questions on how the Bible, say, the slaughter of the Canaanites, things like that, which would be another evening. We've got time for that tonight. But it falls into this category that I'm just hinting at when I'm trying to move a little bit more deeply into the fact that God is love and that he doesn't always act in the way that we would think he would like him to. I think that we'll be recompensed if you take the obvious case, the Apostle Paul slaves himself to death for serving Christ on this earth, that whatever it is he might have otherwise done, he will find that that's there for him to do in the eternity. I think that's one aspect. I do think that there will be different degrees of perfection, if you can put it that way. Some people say, well, if everybody's perfect, we're all the same. It's all I don't want you to misunderstand me, but this hideous doctrine of equality that it means we're all the same. We're not all the same. We've all got different faces, we've got different abilities, we've all got different experiences. Thank God, yeah, we're all different. And God's recompense there for us will be as different perhaps as our faces are, and we will get blessed in the eternity in ways that will be different from somebody else's. And I certainly think that if a man has been a lazy Christian, an idle Christian, a disobedient Christian, whatever, yes, he may find his soul has been saved for eternity as through fire, but he won't have the same enjoyment capacity of what God has got for us, what things he's going to reveal that he's planned for us. You know, the famous verse in Corinthians, things that God has planned for us and has for us. It will be different abilities of appreciation. It'll be as perfect as it can be for you, but somebody else will be enjoying God far more deeply, because he's developed and he's got a greater capacity.
Nearer to him, and therefore nearer to his.
That's another way of talking about it. I don't know. We see it in the church, yeah.
The way that people relate to Jesus to the church.
Some people, you know, enjoy it a lot more than some others do. But
will people be aware of it?
What, that there are differences? Yeah. Oh yeah, I think. I think so, probably. Because they could tell one was Moses, one was Elijah. No, I don't think so. We'd be so altruistic, I hope, that we will enjoy somebody else's success and development more than we will enjoy our own.
But then you might not be any new friends.
Well, I think the nearness and distance are not mathematical terms. I think you better move around.
Some people I'd rather talk to than
could be that just you have different levels of love.
Yes. Yes, that's what I mean of the enjoyment of love. Yeah. That's right.
Rick Joyner has his books where he talks about where he's caught up to the throne room, and he has his conversations with various saints, and there are those who are further away from the throne, and there are those who are closer to the throne, and some of those further away explain why they think they're further away, you know.
I think that we will be unconcerned, frankly, about judging ourselves by other people. It'll all be that we enjoy one another as we are. John Wesley thought that the doctrines of Calvin that were preached by his contemporary, George Whitfield, came from the pit. No question about it whatsoever, and so do I. But when he took the funeral of his, because they had both been a part of the Holy Club that came into being in Oxford, and he took the funeral for George Whitfield, although they were poles apart theologically, he made it very clear. He said, because somebody said, "Do you think you'll see George in heaven?" Thinking he'd probably have to say no, he wouldn't, because he preached these hideous doctrines. And he said, "Oh, no, I won't see him. He'll be so far up the front and far away, I won't see him." Which was a clever way of putting it over. But that shows the magnitude of John Wesley's heart. And I'd rather have a heart like that, wouldn't you? However, I hope that I can see people right up in the front in the glory and say that I'm glad they're there, rather than thinking, why am I not there?
I was more worried that you would be anywhere near your friends rather than
you better visit them. I don't think we'll all just be standing around the throne doing nothing forever except worshipping. I think there'll be lots to do. There's a whole universe to run over, isn't there, and have a look at and put straight, and you'll meet them on the way, you know, as you pass one meter right or something, you'll see somebody on it that you Okay, second thing. We're getting on like a house on fire, I can see that. God cannot do everything. Are you happy about that? Some people quote, would somebody like to read Luke 1 verse 37? And while that one is being found, would somebody else like to find 2 Timothy 2:13? And somebody find Hebrews 6:18. Everybody ready? Are you all listening? Luke 1:37.
Nothing will be impossible for God.
Have you got a marginal reading? Yeah. Can you read it, Sam? No word from God.
Not any word.
Not any word from God can fall fruitless, is it?
Nothing will be. Yeah. Not any. It just says not any word will be impossible for God.
But you see, it is God's word it's in there, but it gets lost in many translations. Any word from God, of course, he will fulfill and can fulfill. But it means that he's going to say everything and anything and nothing. And it is a bit of a misleading translation to translate it, that God can do anything, because he can't. Are you aware of that? Let's listen to two verses. What's the one? Next one, 2 Tim.
He cannot deny himself.
So that's something God can't do. Can't deny himself. What about that? Next one. Hebrews 6. Some. 18. No, Hebrews 6. Yes, 18. That's right. Well done. Well, there's something God can't do. He can't lie. Can't deny himself. He's God of love. Won't do it. He cannot lie. He's, so not everything is possible with God. God cannot make a four-legged tripod. Any questions? No, it won't. It will be nothing at all. God can't do anything, you see. Did you know that God can't make a genuine £5 note? You know that? Are you with me? He could make a forgery, perfect forgery. Yeah, that's right. Well, the numbers will be given by man. It comes out, they've got to come out of the, whatever it is, isn't the Royal Mint anymore, is it? But something like that. Pound notes, or £5 notes and £10 notes must be made by the Mint, or wherever they call it these days. And so God can't do it. Well, I think the coin had probably been picked up by the fish, because it glitters and they go for it, don't they? And swallow things like that. Thank you. Very good question. Keep thinking.
The one I like often is that whether God can make a rock so big that he couldn't pick it up.
That's right. That's an old Greek one.
But if he lives in other dimensions, he might both be able to pick it up and not.
then our knowledge, our vision of God is self-contradictory.
Yeah, we live in three dimensions.
And I'm wondering, well, if people say that, then all God is going
to do it. As soon as God creates the universe, he has limited himself. And the Hebrew scholars, rabbis, used to reckon that straight away. He can, of course, scrap what he's made, start all over again, do something else, and then that way you can say God can do anything. But if once he's made something, he's limiting himself by it. They talked about God withdrawing from that bit of space where he made something, and now if he's infinite, I suppose he's still infinite, even if he's taken a bit of space out and said I'm withdrawing from that because I've put my creation in there. But these are just philosophical points to think about when people make a lot of assertions, and really what they're doing is ignoring the logic that lies behind them, and also sometimes some basic biblical statements that deny what they're trying to assert. God cannot make a free will predetermined human being. Are you happy about that? Just throwing words together, or pound notes, or how £5 notes, whatever, does not solve the problem. There are things that, because God is God, it's impossible for him to do. And if he did do some of them, then he would stop being God and he'd fall apart. It's another way of looking at it. He would no longer be God, because he speaks the truth, and now he's going to speak a lie, and the whole universe will collapse with him. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Would anybody be left over hanging in space? No. Now, I've over the years picked out five side points. That was so long ago since I used these notes. You can see they're pretty ancient, can't you? Not quite. Starting off, God is love, and then an assertion that comes after it, okay? You might want to jot some of these things as we go on. Number one, God is love, and that necessitates the possibility of suffering. It's because he is love, people suffer. When they seek to not love, or to deny love, then they suffer and other people suffer too, as well as God. So God knows this. As soon as he creates a being, that particularly one that he wants to look like himself, because he wants fellowship, he wants relationship, then he creates the possibility of suffering. So in that sense, again, you could say that suffering ultimately lies in God's hands, but otherwise there would be none of us to even ask the question if he didn't do it. But he has done that because he wants fellowship, and I'm glad that he's done that. It's like people, I know some people do eventually succeed in committing suicide, but by and large most of us don't, because they think that I'd rather be alive than not there at all. And the being alive is the gift that God gives, and we want that in our experience, even if it hurts, and even if we're in pain, and even if we're suffering, because it's a bigger thing than the suffering itself. So I picked out some of the corollaries, or the riders I should say, of this. When he wants man's reciprocated love, that is the greatest gift that he can give. The gift of his image, which is able therefore to have relationship with the source of that image, the prototype of it, which is God himself. So God wanting man in fellowship and relationship with himself, in therefore a free chosen relationship, which therefore makes it real love. Not a preordained, not one that is inflicted upon people. It's a little bit trite in some ways, but it's perfectly worth thinking about. It's a little booklet I came across years and years ago, taking to task this whole business of God ordaining it. But if its biggest theme every time is coming out with all the different verses and their interpretations, was just sort of making fun of the whole thing, that if God is making you love him, is it love at all? If you say I'm made to love him, if you didn't choose it, if you're made to it, if you're ordained to it, if you've been predestined to it. You may be predestined in the opportunity to be able to do that. I don't mean that. That's a different way it's equally good way of interpreting predestination. But, because it means you've got the ability to be made to do it, you'd say you're not really a lover. So God doesn't do that. But that is the risk that he's taken in creating a universe in which a free-willed human being, who is a lover therefore, because he couldn't be one otherwise, exists and has a relationship with the Almighty. And that's what's going on around us. It is risky because it causes God pain, it causes us a bit of pain, and it's something which in the end will only be compensated when he gives the final judgment and we set about putting things straight that have all gone wrong, which is what Romans chapter 8 is all about. Where it's all gone wrong, he's going to put it all right. That's justification. Justification is putting it all right. Think about it. not always the way it comes over, is it? But it's a wonderful thing, justification. Therefore, there's a possibility of what I've already used, making a box and jumping in it and living in the dark, making a stick and beating somebody with it when he was meant to be bringing fruit or whatever it was to bless the universe. I wonder what that illustration was. Oh yes, I remember vaguely now. Don't remember the second one there. What's the other one? Yes. I think I remember it. It'll come in a minute. See, I use this, these notes go back years and years and years, where I used to debate this subject in universities with students and so on. And one of the ways I used to put this over was that, yes, that if God was all the time changing things, yes, I remember it now, and you've got your favourite aunt who's going to leave her inheritance to you, but she's taken an awful long time to pop off. So you stand behind the door one day, and as she comes through, you bring down an axe onto her head. But before it gets there, God sees suffering going to take place. I can't stand suffering. We mustn't have any suffering. And so he does a miracle. Steps in and changes your axe into a feather. And you give aunt a little tickle. And she says, oh, my favorite nephew, ha ha. And saves us from a lot of pain. Or saves her here from a lot of pain. Saves you from doing too many wrong things, etc., etc. And is that the sort of God that we would like?
Not truthful.
Not truthful. He's not certainly letting us be who we are, which I suppose is a way of defining truth. He's interfering. Yeah. In other words, he's making us, in the end, do something or be something that we're not, which is what we were complaining about when it comes to making people love God or love Him or loving each other. If I'm made to love my wife rather than I choose to do so, my love isn't worth very much, even though you might romantically think it's rather a nice idea, but it's not in the long run. And it's because people think that they do cause so much pain and human relationships, in marriage in particular. Or supposing saying wicked and nasty things about, you know, we had some wicked old things put in our website just recently, or what is it?
YouTube.
YouTube, that's right. Yeah, words can hurt. I got over it very early in my life. You have to. We had one of our first drafts of God's strategy in holy history, in human history, which was about 40 something years ago, and we just had a rough sketch on the front of it, and Paul had been carrying it around somewhere, and we were talking about various bits. He left it on the train. And somebody sent it to us, and all sorts of vile things written all over, because there's a picture of a cross and so on the front of it. At first you're very affronted, and it hurts far more than you think it will. And it's rather nice that since then I had a book sent back to me, it had been thrown away in Oxford Street, and the chap said, I'm a spiritual atheist, and I picked this up in Oxford Street. I like reading other people's views and things. And I wrote, but he said, how very nice of you to send it back to me, etc., etc. Which was quite an interesting correspondence. But that's compensation, you see. God does a little bit even in this life. But yes, it's a great affront. And when then people say things to your face, they can be very vile, some people say. Worse still when they print it, of course, or put it on the websites, and it goes all over the world. but it just causes a lot of pain to some people. I wish God would change the sound waves as they start going, and people don't hear all these. They hear it all as very nice, and so, but he doesn't, I'm afraid, because that isn't treating us as responsible human beings who have to learn how to deal with each other. Okay. So God cannot do some things, and he will not do some things, and he won't do some things, and they're so bad that if he did do some things, the whole universe would collapse with him, because he would stop being the creator God who is full of love. Okay. What else did I put down on that one? Yes. Oh, this is all number one. Your notes have gone wrong. All on number one still. We must have a predictable universe for us to be responsible human beings and to be able to love. Every cause has an effect, and we have to be able to predict that if we do this and this, that and that will take place. Then we can be responsible and we can be loving. Or otherwise. So we don't expect unusual miracles to be taking place every 5 seconds. As I say, it would mean that God then is going back on his plan, his original plan to produce human beings who are learning how to love like he does. Secondly, are you with us, Paula?
Yes.
Secondly, God is love. So he cannot stop all the trouble. Well, it's a pretty obvious one. Otherwise, he's got to stop everything. Since self is the cause, evil can't be measured by the effects. Not really. You may murder off billions of people like Hitler, and you think that's particularly wicked, but it's no different from the choice that was made in Hitler to remove a particular problem out of his sight than it is when we make a choice over something that looks very much smaller, but it's exactly the same activity in the heart to make that choice. So billions of people being killed off, no different one person being killed off by the choice that's made, which is bringing in hatred. But we don't like it that way. We like to say Hitler is the worst of all because he did so much evil. Well, it's just that so much evil came from one man, but there's plenty of evil in the universe that came from lots of people. And they're all making the same choice. So it's very difficult for us to be the judge. I'm glad we're not going to be the judge. Well, we're going to judge angels. How about that? But we're not going to judge one another. We'll leave that to Jesus, who has been appointed as the judge of all men in the day of retribution. Yes. Yeah. I just put a note here, responsibility of father. I'm not quite sure I did that. Compare the responsibility of father. But if you're going to pitch a screaming infant into this world by your promiscuity, you've got to take responsibility for it. Which people don't. It's the state's problem now. We abandon them or leave them or let other people work it all out. Generally, it starts with leaving the wife to work it all out, or the woman, or whatever. If you bring any children into this world, you're responsible. If you're going to be like God, because God is a father. I got a little note here. God is not like the alligator. Some people think that Job is talking about the alligator as you get towards the end of the book. Well, the alligator just swishes his tail, opens his mouth, and chews up everything en route. And that is power, just let loose, without any restraint whatsoever. So if you can't see any other reason for alligators, you can see it's a good illustration of what you're like when you open your mouth and swish your tail and you don't care what's going to happen or how many children are pitched into this screaming veil of tears. You've got to take responsibility if you're a loving creature. Thirdly, God is love is a challenge to our responsibility. Sorry. Yes. I think the simplest one here is, let's look at John chapter 8. Chapter 9. John chapter 9. Unfortunately, this is variously translated in different versions, which is a pity, because if we're all studying and we're trying to understand it together, it's much easier if you've got just one text to worry about. However, chapter 9, verse 1. And as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, sorry, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind? They saw a sort of a karma, that what your parents did and their parents before them is passed on, either for good or ill. That's not totally wrong, because obviously the genes that are passed on are the genes which your parents have developed, and they have them given to them by their parents. So there is a very close connection in families and through bodies as to what you actually inherit, what your resources are for living the living our life here on earth. So they say, going by the feel that they had along that, who sinned that he's born blind? Because obviously being born blind is not right. It causes pain. It can't be what God intends. So who caused this problem? Who sinned? Was it this man or was it his parents? Now it's interesting that they said, is it this man? They must have had a kind of a theology that somehow or other foresaw what he might be doing or might be inheriting. But it was the idea that, God had already worked it out beforehand, predetermined it, and now because he's going to be an old sinner and do all sorts of things wrong, I'm going to make him blind before it actually does it. That kind of view, again, is argued seriously by some people. That seeing God in his foreknowledge, you see, comes into the scene and punishes him before he gets there. But it's ridiculous and it's wrong, and I shouldn't take any notice of it whatsoever. So let's pass on. Did this man sin or his parents that he should be in order that he should be born blind? It's apart from the fact that it is a bit odd of asking whether the man had sinned, but it is asking a question which is reasonable. In other words, where did it come from? And something must have gone wrong for this to be wrong in the universe, that its results have been wrong in the universe. Jesus answered, it was neither this man that sinned nor his parents. Could you put in a full stop there, even if you haven't got one in your text? He has answered the question that was asked. Who sinned? Was it this man or his parents? Jesus said, neither. Now, unfortunately, nearly every translation doesn't put a full stop there. They might put a comma. They might just go sailing on. But, he says, that the works of God might be displayed in him, or manifest in him. But that the works of God might be made manifest in him. Full stop. Have you got a full stop? Change it. That the works of God might be made manifest in him looks, in this way of translating it, that it's the reason why the man was born blind, so that God could come along, or Jesus coming along, gets him healed, and so glory is brought to God, and isn't that wonderful? Well, not particularly, if he made him blind in the first place. So, obviously, once more, it's a terrible way of translating it. Jesus has already answered the question, who sinned? And he says, no, it was neither that you said. However, that the works of God may be made manifest in him, it goes on to say, we must work the works of him. We've got to do the works of him. We've got to do God's work. And God's work is not making him blind. God's work is giving him sight. Might be an exception with the Apostle Paul, who's so much light it blinded him when he was converted. But generally speaking, God doesn't go around making people blind. He goes around giving them sight. The works of God are to give sight, to give healing. So the second sentence after chapter 3, first part, well, it's neither this man nor the man that sinned, full stop. However, that the works of God might be displayed in him, we must work the works of him who sent me, comma. As long as it's day, or full stop if you like, as long as it is day, night is coming when no man can work. Here is an opportunity to work for God. The day is coming when you can't. The day is coming when it's all being called to account. While you've got the opportunity to do God's works, you better get in on his track of things, and his power, and his vision, and his purpose, and do his kind of works. Do the God things while you've got a chance. And here's a chance here now with this man. So the fact that there is evil in the world and the consequences that come from sinning is an opportunity for us now to serve and to do the God thing. And to see the man healed is to do the God thing, is to bring light to him and to bring happiness and pleasure. And we're working together with God. Without any sin in this world, it would have been a lot more difficult to tackle evil or do anything like that. But because there is evil in this world, it isn't a matter of trying to work out it was actually this man's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, which it probably was. It was a wicked old so-and-so, did all sorts of terrible things, passed his genes on, and it's disadvantaged this man because he was born blind, which does happen. The sin in the parents does go passed on, and it's the children that suffer for it. Isn't that right? If you go bankrupt, your kids suffer, whatever you do. And if you do evil things and your kids receive them or are affected by them, they probably finish up with all sorts of problems in life. It's worth thinking about, praying about, getting yourself on track with God for the sake of your children. If for nobody else, don't bother about your own selfish ideas of getting saved. What about your kids? Get them saved. And the best way to do it is to get saved yourself, of course. But, you know, it's not a matter of total self-interest. It's a matter of willingness to bring blessing and goodness into this world rather than evil. Which is what the Lord is challenging them to do here. To do the God thing while you've got the opportunity. Because you won't always have it. And that's for us to be challenged by. Not finding out that it was his great-great-great-great-grandfather who had a problem. And that's why there's this problem in the world today. Okay? So dealing with evil in the world does give us an opportunity to become like the Lord himself. Go and get ready for your trial tomorrow. Hope it goes all right. So it's a challenge to responsibility, because God is a God of love. God is love means it's all going to be worth it in after all the suffering. Romans 8:18, would somebody read that, please? Thank you. The glory that's going to be revealed to us, or into us, it's two ways of translating ice, is how can we measure it anyway? The measurement, shall we say, of one hour in the dentist chair compared to walking hand in hand with the person you love along a sandy beach, looking out into the distant sun as it sets and so on. Unfortunately, in the dentist chair seemed like an eternity, and unfortunately on the beach it's all gone in no time. It seems as though it's gone so rapidly. It's very difficult, isn't it, to measure how many hours of pain can be compensated by how many hours of happiness. Well, whatever it is, we've got an eternity in front of us, so it's bound to be better in the long run. But the fact is, God himself knows how he's going to recompense in all things. The reconciliation of all things, the what's the word that is used? Not reformation, it's another word. Restoration. Restoration of all things. Or restitution sometimes, or restoration. God knows how to weigh one against the other. And the promise of God here in Romans 8:18 is that it will be just and right, and nothing will be lost. In fact, it will be more than lost. Be over and above. Finally, God is love means he is the greatest of all sufferers in the end. He is the greatest of all sufferers. So why would he make a universe in order to torture himself if there wasn't something bigger at stake? Through all the suffering for himself and for everybody else, he is making a universe because it's going to be good for everybody else. As well as the fact that he will have creatures like himself with whom he fellowships. Isaiah 53, 63, Isaiah 6, Romans 8, they all demonstrate to us that the suffering that God goes through in all their affliction, he was afflicted. Isaiah 53, he bore our sins and our sorrows and our trespasses. It was for us that he bore the sin in his body on the tree, and so on. They're all demonstrating scripturally that God is a sufferer too. Some people find that hard to even imagine. Why should God suffer? He's above it all. But no, he's not. The incarnation is a demonstration that he is in it all. He is a part of it. He's with us. In all their affliction, he was afflicted even in the Old Testament days, let alone today. So, God is love answers far more questions than leaving God out of the picture because we think that he somehow or other allowed creatures to develop that can destroy, like alligators or wicked old spiders or whatever it is that you find particularly obnoxious. Yes, we have got a universe that was meant to be tamed. Some people don't like that, but I think it's true. Even the saber-toothed tiger probably was meant to be cheered up a little bit and helped to sit down with the lamb and the ox and the lion and whatever else. Well, that's where we're going, that's where we're heading. That there will be, through the activity of God and man together in God's universe, that the jobs that's not been completed yet when he made the universe, which is to bring all these things into order, and jungles into gardens. Well, he gave a little picture of that from the very beginning. He made a garden in the midst of the jungles. It was all for us to participate with him in this wonderful business of being creators in God's creation. That all requires that the answers we've been playing with, when start with God is love, are very, very vital to our kind of universe that we live in. Whereas cheap and easy answers don't answer them at all. Don't touch them. These answers of Christ do. As difficult as sometimes they are to get our heads around and to go through them all. Now, to finish, I want to just remind you of this book, Suffering and the Love of God. It starts from a particular aspect of suffering, which is where Job started. And we'll just have a quick look at that tonight by turning to Job chapter 1. I rather like this one, actually. It didn't sell as much as some of them do. But from my point of view, I like this one. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless. My theology said nobody's blameless. But God says he was blameless. Oh, well. Upright. Goodness, I thought all of us were a bunch of sinners. But here's somebody who's upright, blameless, fearing God, and turning away from evil. Well, that isn't bad, is it? And it's pre-Christ. So something's going on in the universe. You know, there might be other people like Job, who was not a Hebrew. Not that that would make much difference, but he wasn't. It's certainly, the friends of his weren't Hebrews either. They sort of all pop along and have a say. But here is a man that God has found as he looks around the earth. He turns away from evil. He had 7 sons, 3 daughters, and they were born to him. And he had possessions, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 cattle, 500, something else, a yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. And that man was the greatest of all the men of the earth, of the East. Well, that's God speaking, so don't contradict him. Each one on his day, they would send out and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And it came about when the days of feasting had come and been completed, their cycle, that Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning, offering burnt offerings, according to the number of them, number of them all. For Job said, "Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. In other words, his religion was not skin deep, it was the very depths of his being. And his desire altruistically for his children. And even whether he knew they sinned or not, he was still going to pray for them. Got any idea? I mean, you couldn't get a much deeper, you know, commendation, really, could you? And this is God's commendation of him. And it came about the days of feast. Oh, yeah, we've done that bit. Verse 6. Now, there was a day when the sons of God, these are supernatural beings, God is the Father of all spirits, their particular constitution is a spiritual one, they haven't got earthly bodies, the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan also came among them, which probably means that we are to understand that he too is one of those spirits, that God is the Father of all spirits, that God has brought him into being in a supernatural capacity. And because of that, he joins himself in with the sons of God. Those sons of God are not all up to good. We see some sons of God in chapter 6 of Genesis, and they were messing around quite a bit and getting out of order, leaving their first positions and trying to act like human beings, producing all sorts of strange inheritances for further generations to inherit and have problems by them. That's sons of God are just another title for spirits, which if you were on the weekend last weekend, which I was only half on, then you came across some of those sons of God. Verse 7. And the Lord said to Satan, you see, the problem here is that God starts the trouble, isn't he? He says to Satan, from where do you come? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, from roaming up and down on the earth and walking around on it. Yeah, what's that to you? I'm sort of poking my nose in everywhere, but I'm not going to talk to you about it. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. So he spells out his curriculum vitae once more, and he does it to Satan. Boasts about his servant. Do you want God to boast about you? You may be in trouble. And the Lord said, yeah. Then Satan answered the Lord, does Job fear God for nothing? Got it? Have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. So what is Satan doing there? Well, he's saying, nobody serves you, God, out of sheer, pure, unadulterated, altruistic love. He only serves you because of what he gets out of you. That is the great philosophical question, challenge in the universe. And the only way that God can answer him, if God had answered him, said, you're a liar from the beginning, Satan, you rogue, get out of here, slap, then he would have gone with a sneer on his face, saying, yeah, I told you so. They're all the same. They don't know you and all your love business and calling yourself love. God is love. Nobody loves you, one, for what you are. He only loves you for what he gets out of you. Okay? You're only loved because of what he gets out of you. You're not loved in your own right as to who you are and what you're like, and that love is top thing, preeminent, and that therefore you and you alone are worthy of love because you're love. You're only love because this man gets out of it. So he, in a sense, is he is what's the word I'm after? He is blaspheming, yeah. He's writing down God's character to which he would then pass on to human beings, of course. He's saying that God isn't worth serving in his own right. Serving love and the preeminence of love is something which is not possible because God isn't worth it. You can only do it because you get something out of it. So he's criticizing God's character. He's not worth it. And he's criticizing God, man's character, because he's saying no man would do it. No man does that. They're all basically, fundamentally, 100% selfish from top to bottom. In other words, real love does not exist. Well, it might exist in God, but that's not the point. God isn't worth it. And man, he never can love like that. He never would love like that. So he's blaspheming God and he's blaspheming man. He's criticizing God and he's criticizing man. He's saying all those fake news about God and fake news about man. How do we deal with it? That is, I would say, the deepest question in the universe. How do we deal with Satan? Because he's doing it all the time, isn't he? He's saying lies about God and he's saying lies about man. And we listen to those, we eat them up, we live in them, we feel sorry for ourselves, we think God is a monster and so on and so forth. People take them on board. So, what can God do? There is only one thing he can do. He says, well, you better take it all away then, and then we'll see. We'll see whether I am worth serving when you get nothing out of it, and we'll see whether he is able to go on loving me when he's getting nothing out of it. And the characters of both God and man are at stake at this point. If he had done anything else, it would be in going to the doctrine, which is the alternative doctrine to God is love, which is might is right. Getting your own, getting something out of it. I'm bigger and fatter than you. It's my might. I've overcome. I'm getting my way. That's the only alternative in the end. Stark alternative to love. God is love, almighty is right. There are no other positions to take up in the universe. And so God lets him take the all away. So you better do it. It describes that Satan's activity, fire falling from heaven. Don't blame God for it coming from heaven. Satan has the ability to do all sorts of things. He's got free will like we have. So we won't go into all of that at the moment. Jump down to verse... Job arose and tore his robes, shaved his head, terrible grief hit him, and he fell on the ground and worshipped. That is the buzzword in the book of Job for worship, for loving worship. Worship. Falling on the ground is just simply saying, I am nothing, you're everything, I just love you, whatever. I'm not going to curse you and die. Naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked I shall return to the earth, obviously, that there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. But that's not good enough just only once. Satan comes back a second time. And there was a day when the sons of God came, presented themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. Chapter 2. Presented himself before the Lord, and the Lord said to Satan, where have you come from? I've been walking up and down, etc. And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God, turning away from evil, and still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause." To ruin him without cause. Satan answered, "The Lord and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. Don't care about his children, don't care about his grandchildren, don't care about his wife, don't care about his servants. All he cares about himself, he's still got his skin, still got his life. Life for life. However, put forth your hand now and touch the bone of his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he's in your power, your hand." Notice, he says, "You put forth your hand," but the Lord says, "You put forth your hand, power." So that's the same word. So often in these kinds of discussions or arguments or trying to understand life, we say it's God's hand's done this. But it's not, it's Satan's power, Satan's hand. In the fight that's going on as to the preeminence of love above everything else, in that fight that's going on, of course, God has allowed, because this is the kind of universe he's made, he's allowed him to take it away, and he allows him. You can blame God for that if you like, but the fact is he can't demonstrate ultimately who he is and what man was meant to be unless he says, okay, you can do that. So the next thing is, Satan's hand, behold, is in your hand, goes out against Job. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd and he scraped himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speak. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? In all this Job did not sin with his lips." Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity, they came to him, and they came each one from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. And they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes at a distance, and they did not recognize him, they raised their voice and wept. So they're fairly decent guys, really, although they got it all wrong. And each of them tore his robes, and they threw dust over their heads towards the sky. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights, with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw his pain was very great. It's a good thing sometimes not to say anything when somebody's pain is very great. It's the best thing they did. For the rest of it, with three and two sermons, they start to put their theology all over him, just about destroying him. Some of the theology they speak out is all right. It's just got nothing to do with Job. They don't understand the very roots of what's going on. They don't understand that there has to be sometimes, places and some people who stand their ground for God and love him when they get nothing out of it. Martyrs. And ultimately Jesus, who is demonstrating in the face of Satan, this is where we conquer. Because there are those who stand there and they refuse to budge. They say, God is love, and I'm dying for it, I'm losing everything for it, but I'm not going to worship the devil whose philosophy is might is right. I'm not going to take the position of selfishness. I'm taking the position which is going to acknowledge God himself, and would rather die, as martyrs do of course, for what they believe is the real structure of the universe, as opposed to the false philosophies that are set up in its place. You know, it's a wonderful book. That was only the introduction, of course, and you've got 42 chapters, you've got another 40 chapters, 41 chapters, and a fourth man comes in on the picture, and he's sort of an angry young man, but he, interestingly enough, is not judged by God at the end. These three fellows are. He said to Job, pray for them. And when he prayed for them, his own situation was turned round. Elihu seems to disappear off the picture, but he was there at the very end anyway, still arguing with Job. But the other three have all their theologies dismissed, and the essence of it is they are not saying anything about where Job is and why Job is suffering, even though they sometimes are saying things that look as though they're true but don't fit that situation, which is why we can't make one size fit all. And as preachers we need to be praying, so we're covering all sorts of areas with different people, different times, different places, different things, so that different people are receiving truth and able to build on it. If you just spout out the same thing every time and you don't ask God to use your lips, to use your spirit, to use your mouth and to guide you in the things that you say, you might be saying very hurtful, like with Job, very hurtful things to him. It's only when the theologians pour theology all over him, he begins to get to the end of himself and begins to try and fight back and let them know that he's in great pain in every possible way. So it's an amazing book, this one, but it's the foundation. It's not every aspect of suffering, but it is the biggest one. And the biggest one is that in suffering, if we're treating it properly, wherever it came from, whoever it came down to us from, or whatever is our own fault, in the final analysis, the way we deal with suffering, we declare God is worth it, whatever. And we love him, and we believe in him, and we're going to trust him. And God says, and you will have to go through this, because I've got to keep on taking my stand against Satan. That what I am and what I stand for, God is love as opposed to might is right, is what the universe is all about. Well, I'd rather die for it even if it wasn't right, wouldn't you? It's so much more right than anything else is. I'd rather die there for that and declare that before the universe than I would to die for selfishness and self-gain and wanting power and right, my own right, my own way. Any questions at this stage of things?
Just on the side, really, I mean, verse 12, it struck me, it says, when they lift up their eyes at the distance, they recognize, and they raised their voices and wept. Each of them tore his robes and threw dust over their heads towards the sky. And I thought, well, look what the stress of that is. Probably we, in the modern era, we could just do that. Release a lot of stress.
Aggro.
You know,
Yes, we probably have to fill in a few forms before we do it. It's sometimes a bit... strenuous to keep going through the arguments they throw up and listening to the response, but there's some fascinating stuff in Job if you really want to spend time and meditate on it. You get very deep into it. When Elihu comes along, he gets a bit nearer to the truth, because he says, there is a spirit of the Almighty. Yes, you need the Holy Spirit. And he goes on and says, he talks about it as a mediator between God and man. And you need the mediatorship of Jesus. The other three don't really say much at all, even though Paul quotes one of them. But and then God at the end, who is this that darkens wisdom and truth without knowledge? Which is a bit devastating. And I don't think, most people think that means he was talking to Job, but I'm not sure about that. I think he's talking to Elihu. Come on, off it. You're only saying the same thing as other guys, but wrapping it up a bit more sophisticatedly. And anyway, he calls them to quieten down, and he begins to answer by first of all taking Job down a peg or two, because you're talking and you're listening to Elihu as though you were there when I created the universe, and when I said to the proud wave, so far no further, and when you've rolled back the clouds and so on, all the things that God did at creation. You were there at the time, weren't you? It's beautiful irony. I mean, it's a magnificent book. The God with irony speaking, just pulling his leg and being a bit sarcastic. Come on, Job, you weren't there. You didn't know. And today, instead of going through all the things that they mentioned there, which is the natural order of things, you'd probably say, oh yes, and you understood what quantum theory is all about, didn't you? And you were there when, you would probably say something like that, what quarks are all about. Yeah, you know it all, don't you? Because he didn't, and he knew that. So does God. And we sometimes talk as though we do, we know it all. So humility is a good beginning of wisdom. Yeah.
Can I ask something about the punctuation in John 9?
Yes, you may.
Okay, please. Jesus answered, it was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, full stop. But, and then he says in italics in my Bible, it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him.
If it's in italics, it's not there.
But, so that the works of God might be displayed in him, comma, we must, so on.
That's it. Absolutely correct.
I was just thinking, is Job a sort of foreshadowing again of what you were talking about in terms of glory, that he had a very good relationship with God in the first instance, and he was blameless, but actually through all of this their relationship deepened, and some things have been shown up that he needs to be more humble, or he needs to...
Yes, I think I wouldn't stress that, because the common thing has been that God used all this to make him humble. I don't think that is the case. He was very humble. He was a perfect man. He was blameless to begin with. That when it says, "And I repent for what I've said," what he means is, I take back what I've said, because in his pain he said some things that you might have thought he's being pretty rude to God, or he's being, but in actual fact God doesn't mind that. He said, "What you said is true. It's what these fellas said that's all wrong." So, although he might have been very extreme in his statements, his whole attitude was correct as to what he was fighting about, trying to understand why he, in particular, should be taken through all this. So I just have a lot of reservations about even hinting that the popular view that through all this he was made humble, and that's why God did it. Or I don't think he beats us up to make us humble. I think life itself is enough to humble us if we stop and think about it. Is that all right? Does that answer anything? Or? But that is a popular view, you see.
But do you think that the relationship between God and Job does change?
It must deepen. You can't suffer without it. deepening if you come through it properly. Anybody that suffers has got more when he's afterwards than he had before. But it's like that perfection I was talking about. He's perfect before, but he's perfect afterwards, and quality number two, or to the power two, or whatever. Yes, very good question. Anything else? Because I've forgotten to mention that bit. That be, it's not to make him humble. God might make use of it to make somebody humble, but he doesn't ordain this. But it seems to be far more humble than I am when he started off, before he finished. So, everybody's asked their questions, so you want to go home now.
Are you going to go back to the tea party?
I hope they're in bed now.
Hopefully they'll be in bed. Mika was watching over them, was it on Friday? And she could hear them talking with his walkie-talkie.
Oh yeah, they talked to each other.
And they were playing, and suddenly Zoe hit his head against something. And then Tom started to say something like, "Oh, but you don't need to cry. You see, I'm here with you." Yeah. And he started to give her all these sorts of encouragements, and she was very pleased to hear those kids.
Who was looking after them?
Mia.
Ah, yeah. That's because Debbie's friends from Cambridge days, they take each other out when they're 40, and so she had a special meal with them, so they had to find somebody to babysit. And they usually go for grandparents, but we were here. I must report that one to Faith, she'll love it. Well, they do talk a lot to each other. They're playing different roles and games with each other, and you can't get in on it. They know exactly why they're saying what they're doing.
You get lost in all the pragmatic aspects of their games. Yes.
Yeah.
Swings are very special.
Well, Joe's put some lights onto their swings. And Faith said to Zoe, "Oh, see, Daddy's put lights on there. He's a very clever daddy, isn't he?" And Tom said, "Yes, he's a very clever daddy." And then, pause, Zoe said, "And Mummy's clever too." And he often says, "My Zoe." He's taken possession of her. He says, "My Zoe."